Hi, I'm Calvin Ball, your 2023 MACO President and Howard County Executive, and you're listening to MACO's Conduit Street Podcast, the source for in-depth coverage of county news and notes from Annapolis.
Hello and welcome to the Conduit Street Podcast. Kevin Canale back with Michael Sanderson. Michael, it's Thursday, October 5th. Things feel really busy here in Annapolis. How are you holding up?
I agree with you. Annapolis seems lively. Sometimes we feel like on the MACO calendar, mentally, the month of September and into October feels kind of slow and soft. But boy, these last few weeks feel really harried. There does seem to be a lot going on, some of it legislative and policy, some of it member-driven, but it's a lively time. It's okay with me, though.
Yeah, definitely okay. And we're going to get into one of the big issues happening right now in Annapolis. We want to talk through the pieces of the puzzle with the state's fiscal picture. There's stuff that we know, stuff that we don't know, and we want to sift through all of it together here. Of course, this has big implications for county coffers as well. So, Michael, what do you think about that? I think we should probably work our way up to the official revenue write-down from late September, and we'll do that. So why don't we first get in, Michael? We know about that. Talk about the Bureau of Revenue Estimates and then the Board of Revenue Estimates and its role, because they play a central role here.
Right. So I think it makes sense for us to try and do this sort of in chronological order. We'll sort of tick-tock our way from the spring of 23 up until just a week or two ago and try and set the context for what felt like a kind of a surprising September. So, All right, dial back to March. Every year, the state of Maryland is going to need to pass a budget that balances to a set of official revenue estimates. So what we have in our annual cycle is that in the month of March, the Board of Revenue Estimates, this is the official committee that basically sets the official projections for what we think is going to come in from the income tax, from the sales tax, these other different tax revenues, things like the lottery, how much interest will come in on income that we're holding and all that sort of stuff. You put all that together and it develops, this is what we think is coming in through our tax system and available to be spent as part of the general fund budget. Then the General Assembly in April can pass a budget plan that balances to that number. So March is always when you sort of sharpen the projections and you use the latest data and you say, okay, these are the numbers we're going to balance to. You do that in the month of March. Every year, that's getting toward the latter part of the legislative session. This is all orchestrated to work timing wise. In the 23 session, we saw the March revenue write felt like a record scratch moment. Everybody's having a good time. Everybody's excited that we closed out the budget with a big surplus. There was like a $2 billion surplus, back in July of 22. The new governor came in and got to basically do a pretty straightforward, we can afford all the things that we wanted to commit to kind of budget. So it didn't feel like a lot of difficulty in arranging the budget plan for the year ahead. In the 23 session, these are new delegates, a new governor, new senators, and so forth. And, suddenly the March revenue write-down felt like, oh boy, maybe whatever's been going on in the federal economy is just not quite as robust as it had seemed by the revenues to that point, right?
Right. Definitely a record scratch moment. And of course, that is in the middle of the session. And there was a write down of $478 million. And remember, at that point, they were talking about, which was at the time, the current fiscal year 23, and then the upcoming fiscal year 24, which we are in now. $400 million of that write-down was for fiscal 24. So obviously that sets the tone in a pretty big way when you write down revenues by almost $500 million. Like you said, there were a lot of people nervous, people looking at fiscal notes, people thinking about policies in the future and how, revenues would affect those policies. And a lot of that write-down was because non-wage income was slowing, withholding was down, and sales and use tax was down. And we can talk a little bit about those categories later on. But there's another wrinkle to this, Michael. I mean, the Maryland economy was and continues to be underperforming compared to the national economy when we look at things like unemployment and consumer spending. And I think that explains at least the decreased sales and use tax and withholding income tax from the forecast. So big revenue write down, a lot of that driven by the economic conditions, people not outspending as much money, so you're not generating as much sales and use tax. And then withholding for the income tax, that was down as well. And again, you know, the employment and consumer spending sectors, still a concern for Maryland. And I think that the leading economists that work for the state are still looking into that and trying to understand it.
Right. So one thing to note here, as you talk about like trying to crystal ball what's going to happen with government revenues, with tax revenue, to some degree, as you try and look into the future, it is the job of economists and analysts to try and guess what's going to happen in the future. But an awful lot of what's happening in the moment with the state budget is very much determined by the economy of the moment. So, you know, most employers withhold income tax from their employees, and they remit that regularly to the Maryland Comptroller. And you know, if you're a shoe store and you're selling shoes and collecting sales tax on those, you collect that over the course of the month, and then every month by a certain date, you remit that to the state of Maryland. So the state has data that's like up to the month on how things look right now. And you can take a look at how was the December holiday gift giving season for the sales tax. How does the job market look just in terms of people having taxes withheld out of paychecks? How's the job market look in January and February? You're using real data to come up with here's where we think we are through March, and then we're going to project from that base based on what we think is about to happen with the economy. So Some of it is like crystal ball and forecasting, but some of this is just reading data that's actually coming in real time.
Right. So that was March. We had the write down. And then as we continue to work our way up to just the September write down just a week or so ago, then we get into June, Michael, and the Department of Legislative Services warns of looming structural deficits over the next 4 years. That's a stark change from last January when they projected billions in structural surpluses between fiscal 23 and fiscal 28. So times have definitely changed and forecasts have definitely changed. So DLS in June projected structural deficits anywhere from $328 million to $572 million between fiscal 25 and fiscal 27. But things get really bad in fiscal 28. And the state is then looking at a deficit of $1.8 billion. Now, Michael, the state can handle cash shortfalls projected for fiscal 25 through 27. They can do stuff like, you know, shift planned PAYGO capital to bonds. So money that they were going to use to spend on capital projects, cash, they can convert that into bonds. They can make modest reductions to planned operating spending, or they can also tinker with the rainy day fund, Michael. And so all of those options are on the table. But once you get to fiscal 28, DLS says that the cash shortfall far exceeds the remaining cash in the rainy day fund, and that would necessitate significant spending reductions or increased revenues. So sort of a snapshot of where the state is going to be, at least right now, between fiscal 25 and fiscal 28. And again, things get really bad in 28, and we can talk about why that happens. But Michael, when it comes to the rainy day fund, and we know all these options are on the table, talk a little bit about that and, you know, how likely it is for Maryland to actually tap into that and draw those funds down significantly.
All right. So there's a couple moving parts here that probably are worth a little context. First of all, for the most part, I think what you and I are interested in talking about here is the revenue side. Right. So what's happening with the receipts from the income tax that Maryland imposes on its residents, the sales tax that we all pay on lots of goods and a few services and so forth, and the other things that come into the state's general fund as tax revenue. So we're talking about the revenue side, but you can't help but be thinking about, well, how do ongoing revenues match up with what it looks like the state is going to need to spend to basically maintain current services? So this notion, like you dropped the term structural deficits, and I'm sure we've got some longtime listeners who are familiar with that construct. Maryland is fond of taking a look at. Let's get rid of the budget of the moment and where we have a little bit of cash lying around or where we have some aberrations here or there that are one-time things. Let's look at ongoing revenues, ongoing expenses, and where do those two match up? And do we have, if you think of those two as the structural finances, money coming in, money going out, are you above or below the line? And that's where the reference of the legislative staff saying we've got a structural deficit that's forecasted in the few $100 million for the near term. That is not exactly the same thing as we're broke today, but it's basically saying there's work to do to make that budget year fit and pass muster as constitutionally balanced.
Right.
So that requires then you start thinking about, okay, if there's a structural problem, what do you do to make one year work and then the next year work? And you're right. There are things that the state can do to shift around. One of them theoretically is, well, you can dip into reserves. And we do maintain what we anecdotally call the rainy day fund. It's a really common government phrase for set money aside so that there's some seed corn in case you need it, right? Maryland has been really reluctant to go in and take money out of the rainy day fund and leave its balance below 5% of general fund revenues. So that 5% number has been something we've really stuck to. And we've talked in the past about bond rating agencies and us being a AAA, fiscally prudent, best practice kind of state. We've been really reluctant to go below 5%. So when we talk about money in the rainy day fund, usually that's shorthand for, is there money there above and beyond 5%? I think we closed out this past budget cycle with about 10% of an annual budget in the rainy day fund. So there is a pocket of cash there, one-time money that wouldn't resolve a structural problem, but it might make a given year, passable if you dip down, but not below 5. Make sense?
That does. And so, Michael, I think that the general takeaway here should be that between fiscal 25 and 27, the state can pretty easily make things work. They'll have to move things around to fit all the pieces in the puzzle to make the budget work. But when you get to 28, you have a real problem and you can't flip over couch cushions anymore to make things work. Is that your main takeaway? And we should say, too, a lot of that, it's because of the Kerwin blueprint, right? And the state and the counties have a big obligation there, but the state has a special fund to pay for the blueprint, and that fund is exhausted by fiscal 28. And then the state needs to dip into general funds to meet its commitment. So that's the big driving factor in terms of the fiscal 28 fiscal picture.
Right. Yeah. The background here that is important is a number of years ago, Maryland voters had their say and said, we want revenue coming from casinos and gaming activity to go into an education trust fund with sort of a lockbox only to be used for improvements to our education investments, not just to use that money to pay for stuff we've already been doing. And so because that money started building up before the General Assembly had really constructed what eventually became the blueprint, back when it was just the Kerwin Commission and study group and all this sort of stuff, before we had the blueprint, we knew something like that was coming, and the state started putting money in the direction of the voters. So we basically have the first few years of the blueprint basically paid for out of this education trust fund because the voters said it's for new stuff, save that money until we start making the big investments that are down the road. So the state's not feeling the pinch. Basically, the general fund is doing its share. And then this, they're sort of like, hey, there's a bank account off to the side. We've got pennies from heaven. It's slot machine revenues and so forth from the legalized casinos. That money's available to pay for our extra funds for the blueprint for a while. The bill really comes due in around FY28, and that's when the extra money is tapped out, and then the general fund will have to start picking up these extra costs directly. And so the forecast for the general fund has a big shock that year, right?
Right. So that's what's driving all this, Michael. And I mean, that sets the stage. So what we heard in March with the big write down and then DLS talking about deficits in the out years, that all set the table for the governor coming to the MAKO Summer Conference and talking about fiscal prudence and restraint. He also expressed optimism, but I think most people who listen to this podcast probably read about that or heard about that And so I know, Michael, that because of what the governor said and sort of the tone being, you know, we don't have any money, we're going to have to really tighten up. You've been hearing a lot about that during county visits when you talk about the budget.
Sure. And I think rightfully so, right? The governor comes to the Mako conference. I mean, we know what kind of a setting that is, right? There's all sorts of players and decision makers and leaders are all around the conference center. We're all at all these different events and so forth. And we reserve time for the governor to make an address to, you know, this big hall. Everybody's there and all want to hear the big thing. Reasonably often over past years, this has kind of been a setting for the governor to stand in front of everybody at the Mako and sort of say, all right, let's turn the page on last year. It's time to think about next year. And the big thing I want to accomplish is this. And they're sort of a ooh, ah, right? It can be a setting for a big, bold announcement. We're going to do this big thing and we're all going to work on it together. I need your help. I hope you got my back. Like we've had that kind of, I don't know, almost like a pep rally mentality at the Mako conference at that Saturday morning delivery. So anyway, Governor Moore talked about, you know, his vision for this is Maryland's moment and the decade ahead is where we're going to win. We're going to capitalize on our strengths. I think a lot of folks expected to hear some of those notes that he had raised on the campaign trail and in his early stages as governor, he's been focusing on them. So he talked about some of those issues, but then there was a pretty sizable helping of our revenues aren't what they once were. The federal support has been waning. We're going to find ourselves without some dollars that had been helpful, and it's going to be tougher to do all the things we want to do. And that was woven, I think, you know, carefully, but woven into his comments was we probably can't say yes to everything. And that's presumably the governor's fiscal staff reading all the same tea leaves that we're talking about. When legislative services, they've got the same data, right? You can see what the comptroller's been bringing in and what expenses are forecasted. And it's, okay, we got a structural issue. We can't say yes to everything when you're already mildly upside down. So that set the table for, you know, County Executive Ball, who's the Mako president, and I have been on the agenda for the county commissioners in one county and the county council in another county. And a lot of them have been asking the local elected officials saying, hey, we're trying to make plans for stuff locally. Do we think this is going to be like Armageddon? Is this going to be a really dire fiscal circumstances? Are we going to be on our heels in the next budget debate? A lot of folks heard him and felt like, okay, like he's sounding that call. This ought to be on our minds. We've been having this conversation across the state for the last few weeks.
Right. And it's an important conversation. And of course, you know, counties go through their own budget cycles. And when you hear about the state facing fiscal pressures, typically, and what we've seen before is that the state will try to shift some costs onto counties. So I know that is a concern in county land as well. And then, you know, as you're developing your own priorities and you're trying to secure state funding to do good things, you also have that in the back of your mind when the governor comes and talks about revenues being a problem and, you know, tightening the belt, if you will. So, Michael, we've gone from last March to June and then through August to the Mako Summer Conference. And that brings us to last week, the end of September, when we know the Board of Revenue Estimates meets again to look at revenues and make revisions. And Michael, two factors typically drive forecast adjustments in September: adjustments to the closeout report from the previous fiscal year, so whether or not that's above or below expectations. And then another factor that can drive revisions is any changes in the economic outlook. So we're now back to last week, Michael, and everyone around town, I think, knew that there was a write down coming. But we really, I think a lot of people just overestimated what that looks like.
Hey, I mean, I will completely own my L here. I mean, so, you know, when the county commissioners ask, hey, you know, you're the dude from Mako, you've been around a long time, what do you think is coming? And I basically felt like, geez, I'm trying to put two and two together. We thought the weakness for next year's budget was in the neighborhood of like $400 million, right? I mean, as a shorthand. And I was sort of putting two and two together and saying, I don't have any insider data. Nobody sends economic reports to Mako. So we're not on the inside. We're kind of on the outside. We hear anecdotal stuff from our own county fiscal staff and so forth, but I'm not going on anything. But I was telling people in good faith, saying, I have to think that $400 million number is going to grow. So like, get ready for 400 to become 800 and or something like that. And what I mean by that is, put this in a little bit of context, like the state, the total state budget for this last year is like $63 billion. The general fund budget, the piece that has to balance and includes most of the things that local governments are directly connected to and so forth, the general fund is about $27 billion. So if you're off by $400 million, in almost any context, $400 million is just like a giant boatload of money, right? Like to you, me, our family, right, our neighborhood, a small town, even a county government, $400 million is a fortune. But we're talking about less than 2% of the total general fund budget. So that sounds like a towering figure if you're the mayor of a town where the entire budget is only $1.5 million. Or if you're in a small county where your entire budget is only $90 million, 400 sounds like a giant tower of gold coins. In the state parlance, $400 million is, okay, we're going to have to do some work. But that is, you know, we can resolve a 2% problem in our budget without necessarily like sending people home with pink slips or canceling programs or shutting down facilities, right? So,
right.
Anyway, we've dealt with $400 million problems without, I don't want to say without breaking a sweat, that's a little too cavalier, but without like bending over backwards. It's when things get to double that size, like if the problem shifts to $600, $800, $900 million, that's when the easy stuff doesn't get it done. And then you have to start making some tougher decisions. You have to, you know, tighten that belt a notch or two. And those are the tough budget years when folks like us in county government start worrying about, is the state going to be able to provide the support for the local libraries or our local health departments or in the way that they usually do and so forth. So that's where we get nervous, is when things get super crunched. I was telling people, like, buckle up. It might be that kind of year. And then let's talk about like what they actually came up with the September adjustments, because it wasn't that.
Yeah. So, I mean, wise guys like Michaels are running around saying, you know, it's going to be $400 million turns into an $800 million problem. And again, I'm with you. I kind of thought the same thing through talking to folks, through looking at the data that was already out there, from listening to the governor. You know, what actually happened was a very, very, very modest write down for fiscal 24, around $14 million. So, again, $14 million to us is a lot of money, but for the state, that's pennies. And the forecast is largely unchanged. There are some risks out there associated with the forecast, and we get into that a little bit. But essentially, you give credit to the revenue estimators. I mean, they haven't made much of a change from March until September. Again, a very, very modest write down for 24. Nothing in the ballpark of $400 million turning into an $800 million problem. So ultimately, we kind of are where we already were. We got the write down in March, and then we don't see much change in September. So that is where we are. And I think we can get into some of the issues raised by the Board of Revenue Estimates and by their top economist. And actually, Michael, we invited them yesterday to meet with our budget and finance officers, a MAKO affiliate, to sort of walk through all of the data. They all saw the public presentation, and then we typically like to bring them in, and they enjoy talking with our county budget and finance officers, and that's always a really good meeting. So I do want to get into some of the nuts and bolts here, Michael, when we talk about revenues and what the state is watching for. And these numbers can change. They definitely can change. But right now, nothing is falling apart at the seams, right? We're still in the same spot where the state is going to be okay, you know, in the next few years until you get to 28. So nothing has changed in that respect. But what we did not see is a major, major write down that would create problems heading into the 24 session.
Right. I think that's the bottom line of where we are right now. So, you know, not as choppy as we had been prepared for, but you know, I mean, it's a thoughtful conversation. So you're right. So let's dig in a little bit with the meeting of all of our county fiscal leaders. These are the professionals who do this stuff on behalf of county governments, and they're thinking about their budgets balancing back home. So yeah, let's dig into what we sort of learned and through them and with them this week.
Yeah. So again, that's a deeper dive with the comptroller staff, and a big thanks to Andy Schaffel, the chief deputy comptroller, and Robert Rearman, who runs the Bureau of Revenue Estimates. And again, those are the folks who actually make these revenue estimates and present them to the Board of Revenue Estimates. And then they actually vote on adopting those recommendations. And a lot of time was spent, Michael, on some of the tricky forecasts like capital gains and other income like pass-through entities. And please talk a little bit about that and why that is so hard to predict. The state is taking steps and has taken steps to try and balance that out a bit and not have so much volatility. But when it comes to capital gains and pass-through entity income, what's going on there, Michael? And why is that so difficult to forecast? And how does that play into where we go from here?
Yeah, I think this is like sophisticated stuff in revenue forecasting, which is interesting, but it's also like devilishly hard to get right. And you have to do some degree of genuine forecasting here rather than just looking at raw data and doing a simple projection. So, yeah, I talked about some of the things that you can follow in real time. Income tax withholdings is like a workhorse number for how things look like this month. And the sales tax, how are people spending money this month? Also a good, reliable indicator for right now. We also know that some people make their income in ways other than a two-week paycheck. So there are people who own property and generate rental income, or own their own business and have the income of the business passed through to them as partners or members of an LLC or something along those lines. So there are a number of people who don't have their income tax withheld in the conventional manner that those of us working slobs do. Instead, they're folks they know they're going to pay income taxes. Generally speaking, the IRS says we want you to make estimated payments each quarter in anticipation of what you think is going to become your tax liability. And you know, there are consequences if you undershoot those numbers, but that's inherently softer. Right. So if I'm running a grocery store as a family business, and you know, there's three of us in the family who own the business, and we each end up having the profits of the grocery store inure to our personal tax liability. Right. I end up with a distribution from our little family partnership at the end of the year. I might be putting in a best guess each quarter as an estimated tax payment. And the comptroller sees that and factors that in as, well, we're guessing that that's what his income is going to be for this coming year. But that is a much softer data point. I might have guessed wrong. Things might be way better than I was guessing, or may worse. And so like these are the areas that are tough to forecast, even tougher than just guessing things like capital gains, like who's won or lost money in investing in the stock market or in real estate or other things like that. You can kind of try to anticipate what's going to happen with capital gains based on interest rates and tax law changes and just what's been happening on the stock market of late. Guessing eventual pass-through incomes by sifting through these estimated payments is just super, super hard. So, those are the parts of income tax forecasting that are more art than science. And I mean, it's testament to our state fiscal forecasters. If they made guesses in March and they come back 6 months later and they're basically saying, we think we're pretty much spot on, the data is bearing out what we were guessing, and we've got no reason to make changes 6 months later, hats off, man. That's like throwing a dart and then going up and drawing the bullseye around it, man. That's a dead on hit.
Yeah, it's really good, and you know it is a notoriously difficult business, especially when it comes to stuff like you're talking about, like capital gains and estimated payments. It's really, really hard. So we got into a lot of that, and Michael, I want to talk about some of the interesting trends that we heard yesterday. And again, it was a wonderful conversation. A couple things that stand out to me. No shock here. There is a relocation among Americans, and that plays into sort of the state's fiscal picture when it comes to revenue. Remote work obviously is on the rise, and the importance of being quote unquote in the office has lessened or been eliminated for many workers. So, Michael, what we're hearing is that some people are moving from more expensive states than Maryland. So think New Jersey, New York, they are migrating into Maryland. But at the same time, we are losing residents to cheaper states, let's say North Carolina, Florida. So we're seeing people coming in and people leaving. And again, really hard to forecast how that's going to work and what that means for revenues. But that is one of the things that, you know, stands out to the economists who are looking at all this data and talking about potential risk, is that we are seeing that migration. Remote work certainly plays a role in that, but also just the cost of living, people coming down from the north to Maryland, and then people in Maryland potentially moving south to cheaper states. How all that equals out is an important component moving forward in terms of the state's revenues.
Yeah, I think so. It is an interesting conversation, and there's sort of like there's a rabbit hole conversation here that's really interesting. I think part of it probably is people factoring in tax consequences of living in one place versus another. But I mean, there's a number of things happening, right? I mean, one is if you used to live in an area that was close to the metro center where your job was physically located, and you were expected 5 days a week to schlep into downtown, you know, downtown Manhattan or Philadelphia or Boston or Baltimore or wherever, because that's where your, you know, white collar job is in this office building, and you need to be at your office on the 11th floor of that building by 9 a.m. Monday through Friday. If that's no longer the case, then maybe you rethink a number of things. Like if that's an occasional visit rather than a daily visit, maybe it's not as pressing to be that close. And maybe, you know, maybe your transportation plan is different, or your tolerance for the costs of difficult transportation are different. Maybe you're thinking about quality of life issues more broadly than you did before you had this latitude. I think there's a number of things going on here. Marylanders picking up and moving to Florida has always been a trope. And to some degree, you know, folks will say, well, it's about taxes. You know, Florida makes so much on basically tourism taxes that they don't have to have an income tax. It's a low tax state. I mean, North Dakota is a low tax state. We don't have a giant migration population of Marylanders leaving to go to North Dakota, right? I mean, to some degree, people can leave for nice weather. They can leave. They can leave to get away from it all. I want to be, you know, in the hinterlands of Tennessee, where I won't be bothered by the madding crowd. Like that's a thing too. So I don't know. I think there's a bunch of complicated kind of social factors at work. Part of it's probably taxes. Part of it is just like, hey, a slower pace of life sounds pretty good now that I've realized I can be a stockbroker from my basement rather than, you know, from the trading desk office in Manhattan.
And Michael, you were on the meeting, and I also thought it was interesting that there seems to be some interstate movement in Maryland. Talk about that a little bit and what you heard and why that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff within Maryland, I guess, is like a microcosm of the whole thing, right? If we're Maryland in miniature, then maybe we're seeing some folks say, hey, you know, I had been thinking about getting a place up at Deep Creek Lake. That seems like a really nice place to go chill out a few times a year. And maybe our family situation affords having a second home or a little place on the lake. Well, suddenly folks are saying, heck, I mean, I might be able to work from the lake half of the year if my work environment now lets me work remotely. So, I mean, let me make sure that I can get a good internet access and, you know, make sure I can still take a yoga class and get the, you know, the kind of mocha latte that I prefer and so forth. Like, I want to bring some of my way of life to that new community. But we've been seeing that in places that are farther away than just the suburban and even ex-urban rings around our metro centers. So I don't know that it's a huge, you know, 12% of the population picks up and leaves Baltimore County and they're all moving to Garrett. But on the margins, are there some people who have more latitude to work from anywhere and are staking their claim to do that now that they weren't willing to do 5 years ago. I'm sure there are people on the margins doing that. And Maryland's probably seeing it, a little bit of outflux from the major metro areas where, you know, land is more expensive and properties are more expensive to maybe cheaper and slower, you know, places, Eastern Shore, or Southern Maryland, or the Western Maryland, you know, area. I mean, head up to the Piedmont. Why not?
Right. And of course, that is really important data and context for counties, because that certainly affects county revenues. So I thought that was interesting. I don't think it's a big shock. I mean, we hear about what remote work means, and it gives people a lot more latitude to live wherever they want to live. They don't necessarily have to be within a stone's throw of their office, right? The other interesting piece, and Michael, this is, I mean, we've been talking about this for years, right? There has got to be eventual effects on commercial property. And this one, I mean, since remote work again became a thing, since COVID, there are empty office buildings all over the country. And we know that a lot of these are going to come up where, you know, maybe you don't want to renew a lease, or maybe you can't make your payment. And that's going to come to fruition for a lot of these people that own these commercial properties. And you have to think that there's going to be a lot of vacant office buildings that are just kind of sitting there owned by the bank, either repossessed or people just didn't renew leases. And so there has to be some reckoning here with commercial property, right?
I sure think so. And I mean, I don't feel like this is making a really profound insight to predict that, but it just feels like it has to be coming, right? We do know that valuation of property just takes longer to work through the system than things like the income tax and the sales tax. So, you know, I was mentioning before, every 2 weeks, employers are sending their reports to the comptroller. Here's what we withheld from our employees. Here it is. Every month, the shoe store sends in their sales tax. But we only get a new look at property valuations. In Maryland, it's once every 3 years. In some other places, it's even less frequent than that. So that's a slower timetable to get new data. We still haven't really seen the effects of, you know, interest rates going up in the last year or so. That should have a cooling effect on people's ability to buy real estate. So maybe the round of assessments we see this coming January will be softer. But I'm with you. Just the finger in the breeze since 2020 and since remote work. And, you know, like, it just feels like things are softer in the retail sector and so forth. There just has to be a downswing in the valuation of at least some commercial property, whether it's, you know, banks or other in-person businesses just feeling like they don't need to be as in-person as before. You know, the square footage you need for a bank branch in downtown Annapolis, we can see just a block or two away from our building here. It's not what it once was. So I got to think there's softness there. It may take, you know, a 3-year cycle for all that to process. But if you're doing county budgeting and you're not thinking about that, you're probably missing some obvious cues. It's got to be common, I think.
Right. And I agree. And certainly that is going to pop up at some point. Another interesting trend, Michael, part of the reason why the general fund forecast is lower in the out years is because a substantial amount of what used to just go into the general fund, so general fund revenue, is now dedicated to special funds. So we talked about the Blueprint Fund. Also, we're talking about things like the Transportation Trust Fund. So in the years to come, revenue that used to just come in and go into the general fund, a lot of that gets diverted into special funds. And that's also part of the reason why the general fund forecast is soft in the out years, because a lot of that money is just being diverted away into special funds. And that plays into this as well. And then when we talk about a recession, there are people with all kinds of thoughts about a potential recession. Is it a soft landing? Is it a deeper recession? Will there be no recession? Well, the state is cautious here because in the state's eyes, until the Fed gets interest rates to its 2% goal, you can't rule out the possibility of a recession. So that is something that the state is keeping an eye on, but it's not, you know, DEFCON 5, where things are shaping up for a recession. We're not there, but I do think it's smart for the state to be cautious and think that until the Fed gets to where it wants to be, there has to be some even small risk of a recession, even a mild one, in the years to come.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk about what are the risks ahead, then there's always the potential for something to happen in the business cycle and for what's a reasonably strong economy right now. If we see weakening, whether it's driven by interest rates or like international shocks or just consumer confidence plunges or any number of things can happen. If you see new weakness in the American economy, then suddenly Marylanders don't buy that fridge. They don't buy that house. They won't buy the new car. You know, they're more cautious about you know, a business venture. And then suddenly the economy of the moment will slow down. And then all these forecasts are off because, you know, if you're in a recessionary environment, instead of having 2, 3, 4, 5% growth in revenues, because that's what the economy is doing, you can have a -2 or a -4 or whatever. And then your numbers are way off. That can absolutely happen. You can't always predict it in advance. You can talk about where are the risks and what are the potential triggers, but you never really know. I mean, if we're in the business of knowing what's going to happen with the economy, then we would all be very, very wealthy in some very warm spot talking about those suckers back in Maryland, you know, fiddling around thinking about local economics, right?
We could be in Guam and we'd still be doing the podcast.
We would be doing the podcast, but from Guam, and we'd have like AI people managing the fort here at Mako.
Yeah, then there'd be more hot takes, I think, too. I think that's for sure. All right. So the last really interesting trend that I'm keeping an eye on, and the state is very concerned about what's happening in Washington, D.C. I mean, who isn't at this point? They avoided a shutdown barely. We're going to have these same conversations in November if the Congress can get its act in order and if the House can find a speaker, you know, maybe we can avoid that again. But a shutdown obviously hurts the Maryland economy and its workforce, at least to some extent. But the more interesting wrinkle when you talk about DC, at least to me, is that the state's projections factor in concerns over federal debt, likely slowing spending. And that would mean, you know, that would affect a state like Maryland pretty greatly. I mean, when you talk about if the federal government decides it's not going to spend as much as it once did because there are so many disagreements, that affects income and economic output in Maryland. This is a new concern. We haven't heard this before from the revenue estimators, but essentially what they're saying is all this turmoil is likely to lead to less spending coming out of Washington and Maryland. You know, we rely a lot on federal contractors, federal employees. So if you're going to spend less, that would have an effect on the Maryland economy and its economic output. So that to me is interesting. I don't know exactly. Again, this is one of those where how do you forecast it? But it's certainly on the minds of Maryland's revenue estimators and what this means in the future, because DC is a wreck and they can't agree on what exactly we should be spending and how we should be spending it. In the eyes of at least Maryland's revenue estimators, that could lead to problems down the line for the Maryland economy.
Right. So that's, you know, that's an obvious note of caution. And for a state like Maryland, where we have an awful lot of direct effects of federal spending, but then also indirect stuff, just the gap around the national capital area includes a lot of people who are indirectly affected. So not only the employee of the Social Security Administration who lives in Maryland and works for a federal agency and, you know, processes benefits that go out to Americans, if those jobs get shut down in some fashion, that's a direct effect on her. But then also, if she doesn't have a paycheck for 10 weeks, then the number of restaurant meals and getting your hair done and going to a movie and other things like that, those slow down. You don't buy that extra pair of shoes and so forth. And then we'll feel that in the local economy, you know, triple fold or tenfold maybe, just because, you know, local multipliers tend to be powerful that way. So that's a big effect. And another one, it's hard to plan for. You can try and watch this drama in DC. That's like a political drama, but you have to be thinking about local economic consequences as like, you know, we're the tail on the back of that dog.
Okay. So we've gone from last March to June to August, all the way up until last week, the end of September. Where does that put us moving forward, Michael?
Well, I think, so it's sort of like the swallows come back to Capistrano. I think everybody in the fiscal universe sort of circles the first meeting of the Spending Affordability Committee as like that year's fiscal reset. So if you're that kind of person and you want to hear, like you're rustling through your calendar, like you want to mark November 7th, this is basically the General Assembly's legislative staff presenting to a committee that's largely legislators. There's a number of citizen representatives as well. This is an advisory body that looks at the whole fiscal circumstance, has a series of meetings and presentations, and they work through things with analysts, and then they issue a report on spending guidelines and so forth for the year ahead. So November 7th is usually bring out the whole parade of everybody who's been looking at the economy, looking at revenues as they flow in. Let's get the latest data. Let's start talking about where we really are. And that's the general fund that we've been talking about. It's also transportation. They tend to talk about capital budget and affordability and all those sort of things. So this is like, you know, gear up. That's the big show for fiscal nerds. Meeting number one of spending affordability in early November is sort of like the next reset on this conversation about where are we? Well, it's early October now. Give us about a month to have a clearer picture for what next year's budget looks like. But November will be the date we start learning a little bit more. And the tone of that meeting, like, nerds around Annapolis will watch that meeting the way that, you know, federal economics people watch the meetings of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve when they may or may not raise interest rates. It's like, well, the body language was so negative there. I'm concerned just because of the way she said that thing. It's a whole little school unto itself.
And speaking of interest rates, Michael, the capital debt affordability is underway starting this week. That feeds into this too. That's a big picture look at capital costs. So that's talking a lot about bonds. And that could be interesting because of higher interest rates, right?
Yeah. I mean, the state has a couple of these processes. They're meant to give guidance and direction for the big picture fiscal decisions that come early in the next calendar year during the legislative session. But you do an analysis like this, and for capital debt, we have a couple of benchmarks that we don't want to have outstanding debt that's too high a share of the total personal income for people in Maryland. So don't make borrowing too big relative to our collective sort of taxable income out there. That makes sense. But another one is you don't want your debt service on bonds to be too big of a share of the state's overall budget. If we go to the bond market today, I don't know exactly what the numbers would be. I'm not an expert here, but we might have to pay, 3.25% interest on a Maryland bond, where 2 years ago that same bond might have been 1.5%. I don't know what the delta is, but a higher interest rate environment. If you can get 5% on just a CD, you know, a completely insured CD from your bank, then what would it take? What would it take to borrow from the state of Maryland? They're probably gonna have to pay you more, right? So we're in a high interest rate environment. What do people want for a 15-year GO bond from the state of Maryland? I don't know, but it's more than it was a couple of years ago. That alters those calculations and limits.
Okay. So we're going to watch spending affordability. We're going to watch capital debt affordability to reset a little bit. Right now, the state, there's no hair on fire, at least in the upcoming session and in the few years ahead. There is a big problem when you get to around fiscal 28, where you can't flip the couch cushions. You can't move things around to make it work. But let me give our listeners a Michael Sanderson special here. So, Michael, if you're pushing or pursuing funding in the state budget for something for the next session, or if you're a county official worried about another cost shift onto your county that cuts right. The funds you were planning to use for your health department, how worried should we be? And I'm going to tee this up for you. Let's go.
I like it. Okay. So a minute ago, like, you used the DEFCON scale, and I think that's fun. It's a little bit like our emergency preparedness color scheme. But, you know, for years and years back during the Cold War, we had this whole defense condition, and like the 5 is actually, that's the smoothest sailing. So nothing to worry about. Nuclear war isn't anytime soon. That's fine. And 1, the other end of the scale was we are actually in an active nuclear conflict. And, you know, from time to time, there would be this ceremonial. We've ticked things from 3 down to 2 during the Cuban Missile Crisis or other stuff like that. But okay, so where are we in Maryland fiscally on the DEFCON scale? Like, I would say maybe over this summer, maybe we dialed from a 4 to a 3. So like, To me, that sounds about right. Like we're kind of on alert. We're watching the radar screens closely. We're watching for tremors and signs of trouble, but we haven't sent out the Air Force, right? We're not deploying. So I think we're somewhere in the middle. This isn't all hands on deck. It's a fiscal catastrophe, but there are more signs that this might be choppy. This might be genuinely rough ahead. So like maybe, let's make note of where the life preservers are on deck, right?
Yeah, I mean, and look, I spend a lot of time with our emergency managers, and let me put it another way. It sounds like what you're saying, Michael, is this would be a fiscal disaster watch rather than a warning, right? A warning means it's coming. A watch means that all the ingredients are there for things to go south. So you have your DEFCON scale. I'm going to call it a watch instead of a warning. That sounds about right to me. And that's an interesting way, I think, to put a bow on this. And maybe that's where we should leave it for today.
Yeah, I think that sounds good. This is like stuff I wanted to get into. I like the conversation about where we are. And I mean, hats off to our own fiscal leaders from county governments. The team from the comptroller's office, as always, spent a lot of time and got into a bunch of detail and handled a lot of questions. But that conversation with them, you podcast listeners, you should have been there. It'd be awesome stuff. So, you know, get yourself hired by one of those county fiscal offices. You can be part of this show. That's an invigorating conversation. But I came away, I don't know, maybe a little less panicked than I had been feeling a month ago. But everybody's watching the right things. That makes sense. You did mention transportation in here somewhere. Let's put a pin in transportation, and maybe before too long, let's do a pod on the transportation picture. The big state train commission looking at transportation revenues and so forth. Let's get into that soon too, I think.
Yeah, it's ripe for that. We know that they have a bunch of meetings coming up. Mako's going to be involved in those meetings, probably at the table for the next meeting. So certainly we're going to have a lot of talk about there. We will post a lot of content and links on the show notes here. We've written a lot about the state budget and revenue estimates, so we'll put all those links in the show notes for you to take a look at. But I think we'll leave it there for today. As always, if you enjoy the podcast, please go ahead and subscribe. That way, all of these episodes will be sent directly to the device of your choice. You can also follow along on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and then, of course, you should be reading the Conduit Street blog. But for Michael Sanderson, this is Kevin Canale. Signing off, and we will talk to you soon.